online listeners, you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM Radio, 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm your host, Roxana. I hope you had a good Juneteenth and Father's Day. Well, this week, we have the most recent Desert Oracle Radio episode from Ken Lane. It's a full hour, so enjoy it. Released on May 31st, 2026. Here is Campfire Tales on a Half Moon Night.
Thank you, Herb Benham the Fourth. Thank you, everybody. Welcome to Desert Oracle Campfire Stories. Scary stories around a campfire. Who here went to summer camp as a child? Anyone? Do you have any terrifying memories of being told stories around a fire? Like, about some awful entity between where you were and the cabins or the tent where you were sleeping? I'm not going to do that to you. Not until it's darker. Let's see. We have some stragglers coming in. That's all right. Oh, we're mostly full. Not many. I have some important information. The crowd control ranger, Harrison, over here, alerted us that one set of bathrooms up there were locked. But you have discovered, if this is true, that there is, what is it, one of the three? One of the three bathrooms. All right, so there's one that is open. Welcome to Joshua Tree. Toilet paper. Boy, that's highfalutin, you know, for us. A lot of us don't even have air conditioning. Or pavement on our roads, or what else do we lack? Sometimes we lack internet connectivity, which is, you know, often for the good, unless we also don't have a phone service. Then it gets rough when a rattlesnake gets one of your visitors, you know. But it's pretty cool now. We have a lot of folk wisdom in the desert, much of it incorrect, but it's comforting. So one of those tales is that when the sun goes down, the wind dies off. So just think of that. If the wind is blowing away your hat, your chair, the person you came here with, is going to die down eventually, sometime tonight. As you can see, I'm wearing a badge. And this badge says Grand Canyon National Park Junior Ranger. So this is an official badge. It's made of some kind of metal. I believe one of my kids got this for correctly answering the little test in the booklet that they give you when you go to a national park. And if you pick the right answers, or if you don't, they're kind of lax. It's not like Harvard. They will give you this badge right here. And then you can wear this badge around if you're an adult and see if you can get, say, the law enforcement discount at Del Taco. I thought I was getting it once, and they said, no, we're giving you the senior discount. Messed that one up. Never even made it to management in the National Park Service or any other role. But We are very close to Joshua Tree National Park. It's the mountains right behind you. They've conveniently put a four-lane highway in between where we are and where the national park is. It used to be a two-lane. And then years before that, it was a one-lane with kind of a dirt passing lane. And I used to have an office in Joshua Tree in a old homestead cabin. And this cabin had initially been about 60 feet off the road. But as the road got bigger and bigger and they added shoulders and everything else, I was right up against it. So the office looked kind of cool, but inside all you heard were trucks downshifting. And so I'd be in there trying to record a radio show and another semi going to the Marine base loaded with Burger King or whatever. We'd go, and so I quit recording at the office. Then during the pandemic, when everything kind of locked down for a while, I thought, well, I guess I should give up that office. It's just a little homestead cabin. Everybody I knew in town wanted it. A realtor friend of mine wanted it. Somebody else who wanted a little art gallery, etc. So I gave them the numbers of the owners over in St. George, Utah. And they all contacted the nice people there. And they would not lease it to anybody. And then a couple of years ago, I was driving out to 29 Palms and went by. And my office was gone. There was nothing left. They totally destroyed it. It was down to a slab about as long as that Joshua Tree trunk there for width, and then about as long as a pickup truck wide. It was very small, but it was just right for a one-person operation, except for the terrible noise. Homestead cabins became very cool a few years ago. And the way they got, well, I don't want to, first I need to find out, how many of you are locals? Oh, good. We got, what is that, about 20%? 22%, okay. So locals will mostly know this. You got to forgive me if I tell stories you already know from living up here. But even a lot of people who live up here often don't know some of the strange stories. I know I don't. Every couple of days, I talk to somebody or they send me a message or a letter, and there's some crazy story I've never heard before that was just going on right under our feet. Homestead cabins came from a interesting program of the United States federal government, the Department of the Interior, had all this land in the West, all this dry land, government land. Some of it's under Bureau of Land Management. Like much of what you see back here is still what's under Bureau of Land Management. Some is under Forest Service. Some is part or kind of the borderlands around national parks. But about 100 years ago, a couple of bureaucrats were sitting around in Washington, and they said, you know, no one is ever going to want to go to the desert for fun, for amusement, to live there on purpose. You know, there's no water. There's no electricity. It's hot as hell for half the year. It's often bitterly cold in winter. It's not much in the way of paved roads, any sort of access. So let's do this. Let's try to get rid of some of that around the Southern California metropolis. And let's see if we can trick people into taking over land that we don't really have the resources to deal with. So they put out ads in the newspapers, and the ads offered usually 5 acres, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, depending on what it was. And it was totally free. You could have land in the desert, the kind of stuff that people pay, you know, $400 a night to stay in an Airbnb on Memorial Day weekend. They would give you the land, but you had to drive out here and claim it. So you had to drive out to one of the land offices, and some Bureau of Land Management person would roll out some maps and say, well, what about this one? And it's just a square and a big sheet of squares. And you'd say, yeah, I think that one looks good. And they'd tell, okay, you go up Old Woman Springs, and then you're going to turn right here, you're going to turn left here, turn right where the thing burned down, and then turn left over here where the road's washed out, and then you're going to be on Retchie Road, and then you're going to be over here. And they'd finally get out there, and they look around. And for certain people who love the desert naturally, even if they've never been out here before, they'd see it and they'd say, my God, that's paradise. 5 acres. 5 acres of sand and rats and half-dead creosotes and these atrocities that we love now. Joshua trees, yucca trees, all full of spiders and spikes and everything. Paradise. But it's the government, so that was never the final step. The next step was you had to build a cabin. You had to prove up. You had to build a small cabin and prove you were actually going to make use of this land. So what you could do is at the Ace Hardware in Redlands, you could buy a whole cabin. They'd load it flat on a flatbed truck, run it up here, dump it. Maybe you hire a couple of guys. Maybe you do it yourself. And you put up your cabin. You probably don't have a well. You certainly don't have a phone line. There's no water lines. There's no pavement. There's nothing. There's no comfort stations. But if you build this cabin and you prove it to the land office, they'd give you paid in full deed to the property, title to the property. It was yours. And so that's how most of these small cabins up here in the high desert between Morongo Valley, way down by the 10, to all the way out to Wonder Valley, another 30-odd miles to the end of it out this way. And these tended to be very simple. They tended to be the bare minimum. But they had kind of a cool look. That became part of the desert modernism idea. Down in Palm Springs, you had the famous architects building fancy things, strange modern things. One of the old banks is an architecture museum now, part of the Palm Springs Art Museum system. I'm always looking up when I see headlines to see if the cops are coming for us. We're legal. We've paid for everything. We paid for everything, and they still only opened one bathroom. But you all have been camping. You're used to this. As you can see, now that the sun has gone down, the wind has completely died off. So these would... The square footage, I believe, was 120 square feet. Very small. So you'd have a window, a door. Maybe you put a little divider wall. They were often made of studs and 2x4, drywall, some siding, sometimes cinder block. They'd usually have an outhouse because they had no plumbing, no septic, no sewer. Now we've got sewers in Yucca Valley. We're moving up. They had been putting in this sewer system basically at gunpoint from Sacramento for the past 8-9 years. Whole roads torn up, whole neighborhoods torn up. But we gotta have that sewer system. One of the places I walk my dog around here, I've noticed that the sewer lines that have come in, dozens of trucks, scores of workers, millions upon millions of dollars, and there are two of those houses that are occupied. But who knows? We might have another real estate boom out here. It's happened a few times just since I've been here. It happened first in the 2000s, early to mid-2000s, and then we had a global economic collapse, so that slowed it down. And then we had another one in the 2010s, the late 2010s and the very early 2020s. So don't give up if you've got your property for sale. Hang on. Another couple of years. There was a Hollywood couple. Actor, actress, who got married. And they read in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner about some property being given away out here. So they drove up, and they liked it. The guy was in movies, so he was familiar with horses and stuff. It used to have to know how to do things. You know, the movie Cowboys, they actually could ride horses. They could shoot guns. They could lasso things, calves, criminals, whatever. Now it's all CGI, you know. Nobody knows how to ride a horse. But this actor knew how. And so he looked around at beautiful vistas. And his wife, who had also been in some westerns and liked horses too, she looked around. They thought, this is nice. Let's take these 5 acres out in Wonder Valley. And we will build our cabin and we'll have this as a nice winter getaway. So they do this. Go to the land office, which was somewhere up the 247, around where the old garbage transfer site is from Burtech now. And then they went back, and life did what life does, and they ended up going other places for work, and they had kids, and et cetera, and they never did it. They never proved up. They never built their little cabin. So that property became one of the many still government land parcels that are sort of checkerboarded in among other ones. And now that's something that's a great thing if you're a property owner. You want to have that empty space. So you might have 5 acres, but maybe there's 25 acres empty around you. And that's nice. You can go out and walk your dog. You don't have to put a leash on or anything. You have to teach the dog not to try to bite rattlesnakes. That never works. But you can do that. They have a traveling crew of people who come up here twice a year to teach our dogs not to get struck by a rattlesnake. It's very fun. I've had all my dogs do it. They put a shock collar on the dog. And they walk it through this gauntlet where there's rattlesnakes everywhere. Has anyone done this? We have a few. So there's your dog, often your new dog, who's just learned to live in a new place and is starting to trust you and everything. And now you go set it loose amongst the rattlers. So the dog's kind of going around. And there's a bush over here. And it goes over and sniffs the bush because there's something over there. And then you hear, shh, and the trainer goes, and the dog does this. Now the dog's looking back at you. What's the point of this? And the next one, they have it under a clear storage box or file cabinet kind of thing. And there's a rattlesnake in there. And it walks over there and it sees it. So what's that? So there's a couple of situations. Sight, sound, scent. And then the last one, the true gauntlet. They say, okay, who's the owner of you know, Fluffy or whatever this dog is. And he's me, and come over here. And they have this cardboard channel that they make with like old U-Haul boxes. And in the middle of it is an enormous rattlesnake. I should note that all the rattlesnakes are on leashes. There's kind of a taped band around their neck, and they're on leashes. So the rattlesnakes are mad already. And this has been going on for the snakes, you know, all day. It's like everybody brings their dogs, you know, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. or whatever. So they say, okay, let's get Fluffy's owner over here. So you come over here like this, and it's like an aisle right here. Your dog's over there. You're here. The rattler is in the middle. And the trainer says, okay, now call your dog to you. And you come on. Like, no. It has already learned. This is the most important part. So you call the dog. You're like, Come on. And the dog's looking at you, and you're looking at the snake. The dog has to figure out, it has to walk around the cardboard wall to come to you. And once it does this, it's smarter than most dogs and many people, you know? So you know you've got a winner. And it comes over, and the dog's happy, and you're happy, and they take the shock collar off and everything. But that's how you do it, and that has saved, I would imagine, hundreds of thousands of dogs since rattlesnake training became common in the early 1980s in the West. And now it's everywhere. So the movie star couple, Ronald and Nancy Reagan, they were the ones. They have become the most famous people who never developed their property. And I've never been able to find exactly which property it is because, like I said, they're just dumped back into the system. They go back into Bureau of Land Management. But Ronald Reagan was a cowboy actor, as so many of the actors who developed parts of the high desert and the low desert. Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, Gene Autry, a group of regular TV and cowboy film actors they worked with developed Pioneer Town, which has become very popular. Sometimes I hear people complaining, oh, they're changing what Pioneer Town was. It's like, it was a fake movie town. Yeah, you're not losing a, it's historical now, but. So all the buildings in Pioneer Town, they have a fake Old West front and then whatever was inside. So it would say pharmacy or barber or sheriff or whatever. And then behind it, you might have those things, but you might also have a bowling alley like Pioneer Bowl. You might have a church. There's still a Pioneer Town church. You might have a utility district office, but it's hiding behind something that says saddlery or whatever. I'm monitoring the light for when it's time to tell something scary. You can't tell something scary when there's still enough light to see around you. Because it's not fully scary yet. That's the thing about being out in the middle of nowhere. Even though you know you're fairly close to Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, etc., you can hear certain vehicles without mufflers carried over. It's much quieter down here than it is on the higher part of the retreat center because we have this sort of berm and we're lower, so it's not quite so much. But I hear that guy. That guy needs to go see the Midas muffler man. You've all been to Joshua Tree National Park, I'm sure. There's one part of Joshua Tree National Park that is well known for being what's called an inholding. It is an old privately owned parcel. And even when the national park wanted to get that land to fill in the boundaries of the park, the people didn't want to go. And of course, it's their right not to go. The only time they really crack down on you if you don't want to sell is if you're in the way of a military base or something. Well, the National Monument or a National Park, they use milder persuasion. Like sinister lawyers visit you repeatedly over the course of your lifetime living there. But the Keys, the family that owns Keys Ranch, decided they were going to hold on to it. You can take tours there, but the land around the ranch house and the main buildings is not part of the national park, and you're not supposed to hike in there. Bill Keys is the guy who claimed that area of the high desert, brushy, dry acreage, not just for his very skinny, scrawny cattle, because there was never much for them to eat, but also for his gold claims and silver claims here and there. And I believe it was 1924, when he had been there for a little bit. He'd been all over before that. He'd been in Death Valley mining and also becoming involved in a crazy situation called the Battle of Wingate Pass. The Battle of Wingate Pass was, well, it was a fake out. There was no real battle. What happened was Bill Keys and this incredibly sketchy guy that he was palling around with called Death Valley Scotty. These two guys were bilking investors in the Bay Area. Said, oh yeah, we found gold here, gold there, silver here. We just need a little more money to develop it. So they kept getting money. It was like an AI startup, you know? And finally, some of the investors said, we're coming out to see what's going on, because we've got no returns on our investments. So a bunch of them come out. Wingate Pass is at the south end of the Panamint Mountains. This is the southwest corner of what was first Death Valley National Monument, now Death Valley National Park. So Death Valley Scotty says, oh, yeah, we'll take you down. We'll go down. We'll have a picnic lunch and everything. You'll see the progress we're making. We're going to be producing gold ore in no time. They're going down the dirt road, and all of a sudden, a bunch of outlaws jump out. They've got bandanas around their faces. They've got guns blasting away, his horses, dust, everything. And it's all fake. It's the buddies of Death Valley Scotty and Bill Keys. They put on this whole show to scare off the investors. And the investors are, all right, we'll go back, and when you're ready, you know, we'll be happy to get our returns from our investment, which, of course, never happened. Wingate Pass is one of those places in the Mojave Desert that's famous for a lot of bad things. That was one of them. A lot of mysteries, a lot of tragedies, a lot of evil. It's where a couple of prospectors claimed that they fell into alluvial sands while hand-digging a mine shaft and dropped down and discovered the remnants of a lost civilization, all underground tunnels underneath the Panamint Mountains. They claim they found weapons made of gold, mummies of some lost race, dressed in tailored animal skins.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at KGVM.org. Now, back to Campfire Tales on a Half Moon Night.
Tables with all kinds of gold cups, gold candle bras, all sorts of treasure. And then when they came back, there had been flash floods, which can be very disastrous in the desert. And they claimed they could never find it again. Charles Manson, who was in prison up in the Bay Area at the time, saw a story about this on an old TV show called Death Valley Days, hosted by Ronald Reagan, and learned about the underground civilization that was supposedly found there. A couple years later, he learned that some local kids had gone diving under Devil's Hole in Death Valley and had vanished in the underground rivers. So after the Helter Skelter murders in August of 1969, Charles Manson moved his family to the south end of the Panamints. They rented an old ranch called Barker Ranch, and that's where they were arrested later in 1969. So Bill Keys has sort of wore out his welcome, and he ended up in this area. He ended up in a place called Lost Horse Valley. It's an interesting thing, the way places are named in the West when they were named by those sorts of characters. The names tended to be very simple and plain and very evocative because of that. It's either where something happened, I lost my horse in this valley. What do you call it? Well, what do you think I call it? Lost Horse Valley. Or a strange desert landscape reminds them of something else. Look at that weird mountain on the river. Yeah, that is weird. That looks like a big sombrero. Mexican Hat, Utah. A real place. Or it could be kind of romantic, too. Look at that mountain. That one single mountain. It kind of reminds me of my dear Molly back in Kansas City or whatever. One part of her, anyway. It called it Molly's Nipple. Now, whether one guy named them all or not, there are seven places on the USGS place names map named Molly's Nipple. Several of them within Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, and around Canyonlands and stuff in southeastern Utah. So Bill Keys is running his ranch, and people show up looking for work. It's pretty much no questions asked. You know, no one's going to check your LinkedIn or anything. If you don't currently have blood on your hands, yes, come on in, and you can work here. You can be a laborer, and we'll pay you sometimes. So a guy shows up. This guy is a Swede. His name is John Samuelson. And he needs work. And Bill Keys says, fine, you can work some of my gold claims. So John Samuelson and his wife Margaret, they settle, they homestead a little bit north of Keys Ranch, and a little bit northeast of Quail Springs, the actual springs. There's a road called Quail Springs that goes from Joshua Tree into the park and eventually goes very nearby this place. So they settle, and John Samuelson is of a philosophical bent. And when he's not working on eight big boulders around the cabin that he has built where he and Margaret Samuelson live, he starts carving his philosophy, a real homespun philosophy. It's not unlike the Delphic maxims of ancient Greece, and things about how to live your life. Don't worry too much about money. Be more concerned about whether you're pleased and satisfied in your work. Appreciate nature, etc. John Samuelson got there in 1924. And a couple of years later, in 1927, the work had dried up. Things weren't going well. We're not sure what happened to Margaret. But he ends up in this real honky-tonk, working man, bars lining every street, new town, a little south of Los Angeles called Compton. And he's in a honky-tonk listening to the band and drinking. And, well, one thing leads to another, and two guys get killed. And Samuelson is convicted of killing one of them. But, and how much of this was an act or not, we don't know, Samuelson convinced the judge that he is crazy. And he was kind of crazy. You know, he was killed a guy, just went to a bar. That's kind of nuts. He lived out in the middle of nowhere carving things into rocks. That's kind of weird. I'd call the ranger on you if you try that today. So the judge says, all right, we'll send you to the Northern California Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And they send him up there, I think up in Humboldt. And within a couple of years, he just walks off and escapes. He wasn't that crazy. And he headed up to the Pacific Northwest, and he worked in mining camps. And then he worked in logging camps, just steadier work. And the years went by, eventually the decades went by. 20-plus years. And John Keyes, who's still down here in Joshua Tree, at Keyes Ranch, gets a letter. And the letter is from John Samuelson. And he says, boy, I sure miss the high desert. It was so beautiful. I'm up here working in the forest. It's dark and gloomy and everything. I'd love to come back, but I can't come back because of the situation, you know, the killing people. And Keyes remembered this. A year later, John Samuelson died in a logging accident at the mill, whether a tree fell on him or he was fed into the big saw or whatever, we don't know. But we can assume it was tragic and painful and a sad end to all of it. Now, John Keyes, or excuse me, Bill Keyes, I'm getting my Bills and Johns. When you go through the Old West history, you quickly realize that about 90% of the men had some variation of William, John, James, etc. So they kind of all have the same names. From William, you can get Will. You can get Billy. Hillbilly comes from all the Williams in Appalachia. Because there were all these Billies living in the hills. Hillbilly. A newspaper reporter came up with it, I think from Cincinnati. Now, Bill Keyes proved that he was not immune to what happened to poor old Samuelson. He killed a guy in 59. We're pretty much in the modern age by that point. So John Samuelson never came back, but his rocks are still there. And they still have these engravings with these various life lessons. And they're not bad. He should have had one that said, don't kill people or don't get caught. But that was in holding for a long, long time. And then, geez, I think it was 2017, our local land trust, the Mojave Desert Land Trust, acquired that land. And I believe it has now been made part of the national park. But it's protected now. You can still visit it. It's a not too hard a walk. I think it's not too late in the year. It's not too hot yet. I think it's 2.5-3 miles from the parking area. Get a map first, and don't rely on your phone, because there's not much service out there. Now, some of us, we can send satellite text messages now for in the middle of nowhere, but unhelpful if you're looking for a map. I see strange figures illuminated up there. It's a guy sitting by a fire up there. Everything gets sinister after dark. I'm going to do one more quick story. We'll have a little break so you can get a drink, stretch your legs, etc. We are in the real desert here, so be mindful. Like, there is a big cholla sitting right there, and I really should put one of those lights by that thing. You don't want to walk into that. And you don't want to walk into our Joshua trees either. Let's have a fable. Anyone ever been to Pear Blossom, California? It's not a big draw, as you can see, but it's a very little town out on the appropriately named Pear Blossom Highway in the far western Mojave, way out there, about 2 hours by car, south of Palmdale and Lancaster, and kind of up against the mountains that lead up in Angeles National Forest. Well, there were two ravens there. They lived there for a long time as man and wife. And they were having trouble starting a family. They lived in a tree, and they had a nice nest, and they're healthy ravens. But somehow, no matter how many eggs Mrs. Raven laid there in the nest, the eggs would just vanish. And they were starting to get depressed. They were starting to get distraught. Finally, one day, Mrs. Raven is flying in from collecting some food, probably outside of Jack in the Box or something, and she sees this great big rattlesnake slithering down the tree from her nest. And she sees, in the middle of the rattlesnake, a big egg-shaped lump. And she says, "What are you doing?" And the snake says, "Just having my breakfast." And slithers down into a hole underneath the old cottonwood tree. And the rattle goes into the hole and gone. Well, when Mr. Raven got home, he heard the whole story. And he said, "There's a rattlesnake under our tree?" She says, "Oh, yeah. And that's what's happening to the eggs. When we leave, that old rattlesnake crawls up here and eats an egg." The ravens talk it over for a little bit, and finally Mr. Raven says, "This may be a bit beyond what we can deal with. I'm going to go see the smartest bird I know, old Mr. Owl." So the raven goes over to see the owl. And says, "We have a bad problem. There's a huge old rattlesnake under our tree, and all it does is come up and eat our eggs." The owl says, "Well, let's think about this. So even though it knows that you know, it still goes up there, And the raven says, yeah, well, we got to leave. You know, we got to eat. We got to do something. We can't just be at home all the time. Rattlesnake says, come with me. I want to show you this mud patch. And the raven says, I don't think a mud patch is where we want to live. And he said, no. Follow me. They go to the mud patch. The owl says, what I want you to do is just follow me. We're going to kind of scoop up some mud, and we're going to form it into sort of an oval shape. They make one. It's like, pretty good, pretty good. They make another one. Pretty good, pretty good. All right, bring these back to my home in the tree where I have an oven. So they head on over, and they put them in the oven, and they bake them. And they bake into bricks, heavy, solid. And they take them out, let them cool. The owl says, Mr. Raven, what color are your wife's eggs? And he said, well, they're kind of a light blue with kind of some speckles. And he said, oh, well, I've got just the paints for that. And he takes his paints down, and they paint them. And he says, now we're going to leave two of these in the nest. And you and the missus just clear out for the day. So they do. Well, the rattlesnake, not knowing any of this, slithers up the tree once the ravens have left, takes a look around, says, ho, 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 two. Looks like breakfast for today and tomorrow. Eats them both. And as the rattlesnake tries to get out of the nest, starts feeling very badly. The eggs won't crack. And the rattlesnake is feeling like it might not make it. So it tries to sort of drop down onto the next branch. And as it does, the two ceramic eggs, the heavy baked eggs, now in the middle of its belly, hang over the branch and won't move. So the rattlesnake stretches and stretches and tries to get to the next branch. And ends up falling over that one. One of the eggs comes over. His tail comes over and knots itself. Well, by the time the ravens got home, the rattlesnake was dead. But it was stretched so perfectly between the branches that Mrs. Raven used it for her laundry for the rest of their happy lives there, during which they had many, many eggs and many, many raven babies and had a big, happy family. Now, unless you happen to have already come across that story in your life, I bet few of you would imagine who wrote it. Front row, even. Is that front row? You're exactly right. The great Aldous Huxley, the British dystopian / utopian novelist who moved to Los Angeles and then retired to 40 acres in the Mojave. And because he was... yeah, he was English. He didn't know everything. He called the ravens crows, and the book was published as a children's book called The Crows of Pear Blossom. It was one of those little golden books. Huxley wrote Brave New World. He also wrote 12 volumes of a work that's known as The Desert, his essays on nature, on seclusion, on the brilliant landscapes of the Mojave. And he dedicated that book to his niece, Olivia, who lived out her whole life in Yucca Valley. And I was hoping to interview her at some point. And I wrote her. She was on Facebook, and she wrote me back. And then next I heard, because I wrote back, said, sure, I'd love to do this. She apparently passed on or moved away or something. So I never got that. But I have the book, and it's a great book. It has nice illustrations. I've changed 60 or 70% of it to make it a better campfire story. Because Huxley put a lot of stuff in there, like Mr. Crow worked as assistant manager of a grocery in Palmdale and everything. So wait, that doesn't help, Aldous. So now it's real dark. We'll take a little break. We do have a little bit of twilight to the west. You can see the planets lined up there, and just draw a finger through the sky. There's our half moon. We might even see something weird tonight. I'm going to turn on a light over here so we don't have numerous fatalities during our short break, but we'll turn that off again when we come back in a few minutes. Again, the restroom up there, one of them is open. I'm certainly not going to chase you down if you head off to the bushes or whatever. Just watch your step. I'd hate to lose someone to a rattlesnake on such a nice night. Thank you very much. I'll see you in a bit.
Waterways hidden from the desert rays, fed families 1,000 years or more. Food was heaven sent, sunlight our sacrament, yeah. Peace paramount, no one was keeping score. Well, some Shoshone queen forging flame and kerosene, guarded by Mojave greens whose eyes like lanterns shine. Buried our laments deep within the Panamints, turned illusion into sense, then she freed our minds. We're flesh and bone, but not alone. Like an old friend who'll call you on the phone, there's always more good things in store. There's water underneath the desert floor. Well, she forged me a knife in a furnace of eternal life. She said, fortune, be my wife, everything between, she said. Don't search too hard, turns up like a tarot card, finds you when you're off your guard, said my Shoshone queen. Well, she danced across the dunes, read the winds like they were runes. I could hear the ancient tune, she sighed into the breeze. Answered prayer for rain, there the lightning silver vein. Cast away what doubts remain, set ablaze the trees. We're flesh and bone, but not alone. Like an old friend who'll call you on the phone. There's always more good things in store. There's water underneath the desert floor. Oh, we're flesh and bone, but not alone. Like an old friend who'll call you on the phone. There's always more good things in store. There's water underneath the desert floor. 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 Much, folks. My name is Herb Benham IV. It's a real honor to be doing these shows with my dear friend, the Desert Oracle, Mr. Ken Lane, who will be out as soon as that sun sinks low enough.
If you're just arriving, we do have a bar. It's serve yourself. There's an old-fashioned prepared by the lovely Mallory, who's sitting over here. Redwood Empire whiskey, maple syrup, and bitters. There's a yellow rose in Texas that I'm gonna see. Nobody else could miss her, not half as much as me. She cried so when I left her, like I broke her heart. If I ever find her, we never more will part. She's the sweetest little rosebud Texas ever knew. Her eyes are bright as diamonds, they sparkle like the dew. You may talk about your Clementine, sing of Rosalie. Yellow rose in Texas is the only one for me. There's a yellow rose in Texas that I'm gonna see. Nobody else could miss her, not half as much as me. She cried so when I left her, like I broke her heart. If I ever find her, we never more will part. She's the sweetest little rosebud Texas ever knew. Her eyes are bright as diamonds, they sparkle like the dew. And talk about your Clementine or sing of Rosalie. The yellow rose in Texas is the only one for me. Well, I'll fly away, oh glory. I'll fly away in the morning when I die. Hallelujah, by and by I'll fly away. Yeah, one bright morning when this life is over, I'll fly away to a home on God's forgotten shores. I'll fly away. Yeah, I'll fly away, oh glory. I'll fly away in the morning when I die. Hallelujah, by and by I'll fly away. When I die, hallelujah, by and by I'll fly away. Thank you, folks.
Thanks to Ken Lane and his musical guest, Herb Benham IV, for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio today. Watch those skies. Stay well, keep doing good things, and sweet dreams. See you next week.